probably if you sat down and started to make a list of presidents, American presidents, who were highly skilled at foreign policy, chances are Lyndon Johnson would not be high on your list. And our guest this morning, Thomas Alan Schwartz, he's an historian, says that that is doing an injustice to Lyndon Johnson, that in fact he was much more, his achievements in the area of foreign policy are much greater than are generally acknowledged, because everything is overshadowed by the Vietnam War. Our guest, Thomas Schwartz, has written a book which is titled Lyndon Johnson and Europe, and the subtitle is In the Shadow of Vietnam. It's published by the Harvard University Press, in which he makes the argument that, in fact, Johnson's activities in the area of foreign policy, particularly as applied to Europe, these were some of the most significant achievements of his presidency. So if you're interested in reading on this subject, of course, you can go out and look for the book. And as we talk this morning, if you have questions, you're welcome to call, talk with us, and talk with our guest. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if you'd happen to be listening outside of the immediate area, Champaign-Urbana area here, or if you happen to be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And I guess one more thing I should mention in terms of introducing our guest, Thomas Schwartz. He is Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. Professor Schwartz, hello.
Yes.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on this program.
We appreciate it. And I suppose the one thing to start with, as you do, is probably the reason, if people think that President Lyndon Johnson's presidency was a failure on foreign policy grounds, there's really only one reason for thinking that, and it is indeed Vietnam. That's what people will think of.
Yes. Yeah, that is. And that certainly was my view. And in part, the opportunity in some ways to look more broadly at his foreign policy, to gain some distance and to see it in light of the years that followed, in particular, of course, the ultimate outcome of the Cold War, I think offers a different perspective, and it offers a perspective that places Vietnam certainly Vietnam remains a very significant and important point, but also allows us to see other aspects of his foreign policy, in particular his ability to manage the North Atlantic Alliance and to deal with the European partners who really were central as well during this period.
I'm sure that when people think of Johnson, as we say, the in the foreign policy arena, the thing they're going to think of is Vietnam. If they think of his successes or where his skills lie, they will think about domestic issues and think about his political skills at home, dealing with the Congress, thing that he learned as a member of Congress then before he became president. So why is it that it seems that so little attention is devoted to this other area and foreign policy outside of Vietnam? Just because Vietnam, as the title suggests, it casts a shadow over everything.
Yes, that's basically the point I make. But I think it's also because there were no extraordinarily dramatic moments in European policy during the Johnson years, in the sense that before that time, and certainly if you think about President Kennedy's presidency and even the end of Eisenhower's presidency, there were these dramatic moments in Europe, in particular the Berlin crisis and the whole building of the wall and all the issues connected to that. In effect, Johnson deliberately in 1963 and 64, in the first years of his presidency, did turn his attention to domestic affairs and, most importantly, of course, the Civil Rights Act and economic policy, the war on poverty, these sorts of things. So there was very much a dramatic shift in presidential attention, and that has obscured the fact that he then returned to European policy subsequently into his presidency when Vietnam began to overshadow other aspects. So I think it's partly the deliberate, very deliberate policy actions of the president, but also I think if you consider historically what was going on during that time, there weren't the dramatic moments during the Johnson presidency that there were during the Kennedy years.
Well, this is the time of the Cold War where the defining sort of relationship around which so much else revolved was the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union. And here, I think the point you make is that Johnson believed and acknowledged that the relationship between Europe and the United States was very important in dealing with that other larger relationship.
Yes.
What did Johnson? Was there actually a kind of a stated policy? If you said, "All right, Mr. President, what exactly is your policy in regards to Europe?" Was there something that was actually articulated?
Yes, there was, and this has actually been overshadowed again by Vietnam. But Johnson gave a very important speech on European policy in October of 1966, in which he laid out really the idea that our policy toward Europe would be based on, you might say, two twin pillars of both deterrence and détente, namely that the United States, recognizing that there was a clearly defined line in Central Europe that ran through the center of Berlin, ran through the center of Germany, would understand that that would not disturb, you might say, Soviet possessions or would not try to undermine Soviet rule in these areas aggressively, but would, in fact, peacefully compete and try to peacefully build bridges again between Western and Eastern Europe, and that it would, in effect, recognize that in a nuclear age there could be no confrontations, rollbacks, the type of thing that had been said in the 1950s during the Eisenhower years. But in effect, it would accept the status quo within Europe within a peaceful frame of building bridges, cooperating, and trying to lessen the hardships created by the division of Europe. In that sense, and it was more recognized, and this was something I found by examining documents in Britain and France and Germany, the Europeans clearly had a sense of what Johnson's policy was. It wasn't, again, because of the Vietnam War, Americans were not as concerned or interested in it, but the Europeans certainly did, and they recognized that Johnson was determined to pursue a peaceful relationship with the Soviet Union and that he would, in effect, subordinate policies in Europe toward the goal of a cooperative relationship with the Soviet Union that in particular lessened the danger of nuclear war. And that was an overriding priority for Johnson, was to prevent any nuclear confrontation of the type that had occurred during the Kennedy years.
Certainly there here in the persons of Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy, you have two people who seem, at least on the surface, to be very, in their personality, very different. And in their
yes.
background, someone who, Kennedy, someone very sophisticated, and Johnson somewhat rougher. Johnson, someone who certainly did got his political training and his experience in kind of really bare-knuckle politics, and that was why
yes.
he was so good at dealing with Congress. And he also had something of a reputation of being a bully, that he would, if he wanted something from you, he was going to lean on you until he got what he wanted. So,
well, that's right, yeah.
And I don't know if he particularly had a reputation for being an internationalist before he got to be president. I wonder how, when he first became president, what various leaders in Europe thought about him, what sort of image of him they had. It certainly must have been very different than the way that they thought about Kennedy.
It was. And it was a there are certain stereotypes Europeans have. One of them, of course, is connected to Texas and the South, the idea that someone from that part of the country somehow is less connected to Europe. And Kennedy's connection to Europe was very intense. I quote in my book the columnist from the London Times, Henry Brandon, who was a very very well-known figure in Washington and wrote on these subjects that, in effect, Kennedy was almost part European, and Europeans thought of him in that context. They thought of him as very much connected to their culture and society, and, of course, Johnson was not. And de Gaulle, in particular the French, found that Johnson, in their sense, sort of confirmed all of their worst stereotypes of an American political leader. The British had this sense that he would only be concerned with domestic politics. The Germans probably had a little bit more open-minded, but they also saw him in terms of some of the stereotypes, cultural stereotypes connected to their view of the West and Texas and cowboys and Indians and these sorts of things. The thing is that Johnson actually did have, this is again not as well known about his career, but he had been Senate Majority Leader during the 1950s. It cooperated very intensively with President Eisenhower in laying the basis for bipartisan foreign policy. He understood fully, I think, the nature of the American role in Europe, the importance of the Western Alliance, many of these political issues. The fact that he was determined initially to focus on domestic policy, I think, was misleading to some European leaders. And it led them to think that he would have less direct interest in some of the problems in Europe. In effect, I think there was a sense that Johnson had initially that European policy was in good shape and that right now the United States needed to attend to its domestic problems, in particular the crisis over civil rights and these other issues that were particularly acute in 1963, 64, and 65. So I do think European leaders missed some of this about the president, but gradually came to recognize that in terms of his understanding of the problems and complexities of the alliance, that they could speak to him, as Harold Wilson of Britain used to put it, as politician to politician, that he understood the issues they faced and that he would try to help them as politicians within their own domestic context if they would reciprocate that. And in that sense, he behaved within the Western alliance like he used to behave within the United States Senate. And this might be seen by some people as missing something, being too provincial. But in fact, I think in the way alliance politics works, it's actually not a bad analogy at all.
Hmm. Well, I think it's interesting to hear you talk about that, the fact that, they understood that he could and would deal with them politician to politician, because that's exactly the way I would I think of him operating at home.
Yes.
And but then one wonders, well, is that going to translate into your relationship with somebody who was the leader of another country, that, you know, where their style of relating might be different, or
right,
their politics is going to be different, or, you know, in this kind of you know, when you think of him in particular, you see pictures of him talking with people, looming over them, toe to toe, looking like, you know, he's looking this guy right in the eye, and he's almost like got his finger in their face, saying to him, "Okay, now here is what you are going to do." You know, you wonder now, would that fly with the Prime Minister of Britain or of Germany or of France or someplace like that? How would they relate to that kind of really intense person-to-person force of personality, style of politics that he had?
Interestingly enough, not badly. I mean, there were conflicts, obviously, but the British Prime Minister Wilson actually found himself quite engaged by Johnson. There were conflicts. I don't want to minimize that. Particularly Wilson disagreed with aspects of the Vietnam policy. He was not Tony Blair in the sense of the way Blair acted with the current Texan in the White House. That was not Harold Wilson. But on the other hand, on many issues, Johnson and Wilson really were very compatible politically in understanding what the basis of their support was, what types of things they needed to do and accomplish in their meetings. Johnson understood that Wilson faced limitations because of his party's left wing. He didn't push him too hard on certain issues because of that. It also worked fairly effectively initially with the German chancellor. It became more of a problem, and I chronicle this in the book, when for domestic reasons, the German prime minister, Ludwig Erhard, or German chancellor, was no longer able really to deliver on his promises. But Johnson was able to restore was able to conduct a fairly effective relationship with, particularly in Britain and Germany. Now, the case in France and President Charles de Gaulle, that's a whole different issue. But that has as much to do with, I think, de Gaulle's priorities during the time as it does with anything about Johnson's style.
Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last few minutes here. We're speaking with Thomas Alan Schwartz. He is Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. And he is author of a recently published book, which is titled Lyndon Johnson and Europe in the Shadow of Vietnam. It's published by the Harvard University Press, and it takes a look at Lyndon Johnson and his policy toward Europe, the way that he felt about the importance of Europe, the relationship between the countries of Europe and the United States. And Professor Schwartz makes the argument in the book that people who would say that because of Vietnam, Johnson's presidency was a failure on the foreign policy front, he would say, that is, Professor Schwartz would say, that that's doing a great injustice to Lyndon Johnson, and in fact, his policy toward Europe may be one of the most significant things about his presidency. If you're interested in reading the book, you can, of course, go out and look for it. And here on this program, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800 1-800-222-9455. And I suppose, again, at this point, when people think about the issues that would be of greatest concern, particularly when we're talking about the relationship between U.S. and Soviet Union, the tensions there, and how Europe plays into that, they'd think, well, the security issues would be the number one sort of thing. Perhaps, though, let's talk a little bit about economic issues and yes. how it is that Johnson thought about that and economic relations, trade relations and so forth involving mm-hmm. Europe and the United States.
Johnson was a big believer, and this one can track this in historical terms to his Southern roots, but he was a big believer in, at least in the principle of free trade and in encouraging a expanding international economy. And in terms of his presidency, the issues of the international economy became quite acute, in particular because there was an ongoing problem with the American dollar's role within that economy and the idea that perhaps there should be other means of creating reserves within by international agreement, and there was a whole set of negotiations on that to expand the international reserves to facilitate the growth of the international economy and to conserve and growing international trade. Johnson was really quite caught up, and this is again something that goes against some of the stereotypes. He was very much aware of the importance of a growing and expanding domestic economy and international economy to facilitate some of the larger policy objectives that he had. He never, for example, believed that the war on poverty or any alleviation of some of the social ills within the United States could come without a growing economy. So he spent a lot of time on this issue, and his primary concern was to make sure that the international economy also reflected, you might say, the growth principle, that the rising tide lifts all boats, was the John Kennedy quote about an expanding economy and its ability to facilitate the solution to social problems and poverty and other issues. So Johnson was very concerned with that. He promoted trade. And in fact, in his administration, again overshadowed by, I think, the problems of Vietnam, he was able to get one of the last major international trade agreements of the 1960s, the Kennedy Round of Agreements that expanded international trade, agreed in 1967 with the European Community, and the creation of the special drawing rights. This is a tool used by the International Monetary Fund to facilitate the growth of reserves, to facilitate reserves and to facilitate international trade. Both of those agreements were under his presidency.
I'm sure, you know, when we're talking about shadows, that Johnson, when he came to the presidency, there was the shadow of John Kennedy. And
yes.
I'm certain that he, that is Johnson, had to, on the one hand, respect and honor and sort of stand by the positions of the previous administration, in which, after all, he was the vice president. And yet, at the same time, I'm certain that he had his own ideas and would have felt the necessity, if not the desire, to have his own policies and not simply be seen as some kind of a caretaker, but yes. president in his own right. In to what extent did he was he carrying on the policies of the Kennedy administration, and then what was it? Was it difficult? Was it something of a struggle, a challenge to develop his own kind of policies?
I think that's an excellent point, and it's a hard issue to come to terms with, because so much of the writing on the Johnson years is caught up, at least some of the political writing, with Johnson's rivalry, insecurity in relation to the Kennedys and his relationship with Robert Kennedy, for example. There's a wonderful book on that relationship called Mutual Contempt, which gets at some of these issues and sees Johnson sometimes as deliberately changing policy solely to avoid being seen as following Kennedy or dealing with Robert Kennedy. So it's an important issue, but I think it's been overdrawn. In that, I think Johnson, on the whole, shared the basic principles that Kennedy was looking to achieve at the end of his life. But Kennedy left him a confused legacy. On the one hand, Kennedy had these grand designs in European policy that would involve a very activist American policy in trying to shape Europe. This was a policy that Kennedy at least initially pursued, but began to have doubts about toward the end of his life, actually. In particular, for example, one of the policies of the Kennedy administration was creating a multilateral nuclear force, which was a way to give the Germans some share in the responsibility to use nuclear weapons. Kennedy began to have doubts about this, but his public pronouncements were in favor of it because it was a policy of strengthening alliance ties. Well, Johnson basically had to, in a sense, pursue the negative there. He eventually found that pursuing that type of policy would complicate relations with the Soviet Union, who were very eager and in fact, almost paranoid about the idea of the Germans having any role in nuclear weapons. And in fact, Johnson ended up very diplomatically eventually burying the multilateral force in order to pursue what I think was one of his major achievements in foreign policy, namely the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is still one of the absolute central features of American security policy. One of the major things we're engaged in even up to this day is trying to prevent countries from getting nuclear weapons. And this was an achievement of the Johnson administration and had to be negotiated with the Soviet Union. And one of their major concerns was simply to make sure that Germany, West Germany at the time, did not get nuclear weapons. And Johnson pursued that policy. So, yes, he did put his personal stamp. Sometimes it had to be a sort of negative stamp of getting rid of policies of Kennedy's that were increasingly counterproductive. But I think, in effect, he shared the basic view of the Kennedy administration that Kennedy expressed in a speech at American University that's often quoted in June of 63, that we share a basic interest with the Soviet Union, that we're all mortal, we want to live, we don't want to destroy the world by nuclear war. And this was, I think, a sort of central view that Johnson also was pursuing and trying to achieve.
Certainly, this the current administration has been criticized by a number of people for unilateralism, for basically saying, well, this is the United States and this is our policy, and if you don't like it, that's too bad. I'm sure that the United States and its involvement in Vietnam, as you've talked about, United States, its involvement in Vietnam caused some tension between the United States and the president and the leaders of the other countries. But I guess I wonder to what extent that Johnson felt it was important to have the support of those other governments to whatever degree that they would give it, and in fact did make efforts to persuade them to lend whatever the support they could, and would have, you know, he would have said, yes, it does matter to us, the United States, what these leaders of European countries think. So we're going to do what we can to try to persuade them that our policy is correct and necessary. And we're not just simply going to say, well, whether you like it or not, you know, this is what we've decided we're going to do, and if you don't like it, tough.
Yeah. No, Johnson was very much caught up with the hope that he could get other countries to involve themselves in the Vietnam War. With the major European countries, it was a mixed issue because each of them had, for particular reasons, concerns that both limited their involvement but also affected their perspective. With Germany, for example, there was no question about German soldiers being involved in Vietnam or Germany making a military contribution. World War II was less than two decades away. The idea of Germans serving outside of the European theater was just impossible in German public opinion, and was something that Johnson very quickly and recognized and was made clear to in almost all these communications. The Germans did give some financial aid. They sent hospital ships. They did some civilian help. And in fact, Germany's leaders generally saw the world the same way and actually did at least initially support the commitment in Vietnam and see their own situation in a divided country as similar to that of Vietnam. They gradually grew disillusioned by the later period, but in the initial period, they supported the commitment. Britain was more skeptical. The British were also members of the Geneva Conference or had done that and were more skeptical about the American commitment. Wilson publicly supported Johnson, but he also saw and felt that Britain should mediate the conflict and spent a good deal of his time trying to actually work out a mediation of the conflict. But on the whole, remained publicly supportive of the United States, much to the distress of some of the left-wing figures in his Labor Party. France was almost completely opposed in the figure of de Gaulle, and that had both to do with their own view that Vietnam was not the Vietnam conflict had nothing to do with the international containment, the containment of communism, but also to do with their own sort of very nasty experience of defeat in Vietnam and their own feeling the United States, of course, had not supported them in that situation when they were defeated. And de Gaulle, for one, was very, very negative about Vietnam from the very beginning. And that was a source of tension between the United States and France. Mm.
Certainly, and as you have said, that perhaps the most difficult relationship of this time was the relationship between France and the United States.
Yes.
And I think you make your point in point out in the book that Johnson really believed in the alliance, believed in the alliance between Europe and the United States, and thought that it was very important. So here, then, one would think that one of the most difficult periods, perhaps, one of the biggest issues that would have come up was the dispute between the United States and France over NATO.
Yes.
And the attack of the French government on the very concept of the alliance.
Yes.
And this was apparently a case where Johnson, his advisors told him that he should really be tough. He should get tough with the French.
Yes.
And that he decided, no, and in fact, that really wasn't the way to go.
Yeah. No, this is actually, I think, one of the issues that, at least to the extent reviewers sort of see a modern parallel, a number of them have commented on the sort of parallel of an American president dealing from Texas, dealing with a nationalist French leader who opposed his policy on a war issue. And there are some interesting parallels. Johnson and de Gaulle really were totally like fire and water. They had very little, no personal chemistry. I had to strain to find a picture of the two of them. They did not meet during the presidency. They met twice, very shortly, once when de Gaulle came to pay his respects at Kennedy's funeral and then briefly at Adenauer's funeral, but they had no contact, personal chemistry or contact at all. Yes, this was a huge problem. The French were challenging the whole basis of American national security policy and the alliance policy, in effect, by asking the United States, or not asking, actually demanding that the United States withdraw its forces from France and that NATO withdraw its presence from Paris. NATO headquarters was in Paris in the early 1960s and was forced then to go to Brussels in Belgium. As an attack on the United States, this was seen by many and as a repudiation of America's role in liberating France. There's actually a cartoon from this period by the political cartoonist Bill Malden that has a picture of Charles de Gaulle standing in a cemetery of white crosses saying, "Why do you Americans stay where you don't belong?" The same sort of sentiment that was expressed quite passionately during the Iraq War about America's role in sacrificing for France's freedom and this sort of thing. So these passions were out there. The public passions were out there. Johnson deliberately decided not to inflame them and to turn the NATO dispute into a major issue. I think he could have for short-term domestic political gain, but he decided against it, and he decided, I think, on the basis of the idea that in the long run, the alliance would heal. De Gaulle's defiance would not make sense over the long run, and the United States and France would come back working together against the Soviet Union, or at least in deterring the Soviet Union, and so that to shake the alliance at its core for short-term political expediency would not be a good measure. Many of his advisors who were on the whole, the cream of the American elite, foreign policy elite of the time, Dean Acheson, George Ball, John McCloy, figures who had traveled extensively, who were cosmopolitan, they wanted him to go after de Gaulle. They wanted a strong personal confrontation. They wanted him to use Germany also against France, use the American connection to Germany as a way of trying to punish France, a term that's been used a lot lately. Johnson refused it and actually acted quite deliberately against that policy. He worked very quietly, diplomatically, to isolate France, to reconstruct NATO with the British and Germans together, but not to engage in a public confrontation with de Gaulle that he thought would be more damaging in the long run to the alliance and to America's position in the world. And I think that's a point that's often forgotten, that Johnson was, I think, more perceptive, I think, about long-term foreign policy interests of the United States than is often thought because of the Vietnam War.
We have a caller. We'd welcome others. Let's bring this person into the conversation in Charleston on our line 4. Hello.
Yes. I'm thinking of the parallels between Lyndon Johnson and George W. Bush. And Mr. Johnson's a huge intellect compared to this fellow, but they seem both to equivocate the judgments of what has and will mark these administrations. When Johnson trumped up the Gulf of Tonkin incident that put the U.S. into Vietnam, and now with George W. Bush, who has, with weapons of mass destruction, which are still not found, as an excuse to go to Iraq. And all the parallels between these two people and the continuing foreign policy machinations of the U.S. And trying to extend and to push their hegemony far beyond others, and now naming themselves almost disgusting to think as the world's only superpower seems rather mad. You know, I understand that that's the way the world has worked up to date, but with the influence of nuclear weapons seems to me to be threatening all of life on this planet, and how it can continue to evolve the way it does and to percolate the ignorance of the American population into all that and paint everything red, white, and blue, and as if we are always right when it's patently obvious, should be patently obvious, that it is all wrong. That's why I compare Mr. Johnson to Bush, because Johnson, I think, was a far, his thinking was far-reaching and would refuse the atomic option. And lastly, on the BBC, I caught this about 2 weeks ago or 10 days, that if somewhere in Nebraska a conference was held to see how atomic weapons would play into these world conflicts, reducing the megatons to make it less far-reaching and the decimation of wherever they were dropped as now an option of the world's only superpower. And that's my comment, is the parallels between Johnson and Bush 2, and really Bush 1, and the present circumstances that humanity finds itself in. And I'll just hang up and listen, and thank you very much.
All right. Bye. Well, Professor Schwartz, what do you think?
Well, the caller actually raised a lot of very interesting points, but let me talk about one particular about nuclear weapons. And I do think on this point, Johnson's presidency is under-recognized for the degree to which he and to some extent Kennedy as well, but there was a period of time in the 1950s where nuclear weapons, one of the arguments of the Eisenhower years was nuclear weapons should be seen as another weapon, only more destructive, but as a legitimate weapon in the American arsenal. And it really, beginning with Kennedy, but also very strongly with Lyndon Johnson, and this was intensified in the 1964 campaign with Goldwater, who also talked about the possibility of using limited nuclear war. Johnson made the argument nuclear weapons were not like other weapons. They would not be – they were a weapon of not only last resort but almost unthinkable destructiveness. And then he reinforced what the political scientist Thomas Schelling has called the nuclear taboo in American ideas, that nuclear weapons were something outside of the possible, and that something should be worked toward limitation and toward, in fact, even abolition, or at least the idea being that they were not simply another weapon, that they were indeed the ultimate weapon. And I think on that score, Johnson was very, very much aware of the destructive power of nuclear weapons and wanting to avoid it. As far as some of these other the issues of trumping up an issue to get into war, that it is interesting. The Gulf of Tonkin has been raised a lot as a parallel incident to the weapons of mass destruction incident. And to some extent, I think that's, in a way, not a bad analogy. There is to some degree the use of a pretext to justify, in fact, the carrying out of a policy that was seen to be necessary for other reasons was the case in Vietnam. I think the contrast probably would be that in this case, Johnson, there was an actual Gulf of Tonkin incident. In fact, the first incident actually did occur. North Vietnamese boats did attack an American boat. The second incident, which is the one that's more disputed, was the one, of course, that is still used or seen as having been trumped up. But the larger question that Johnson felt that he had to pursue a policy of containment in Vietnam was connected, I think, to this sense that he had that the stability of international politics rested on the credibility of the United States. And that stability had been achieved in Europe but had not yet been achieved in Asia, and that was what Johnson sought to achieve in Vietnam. Now, tragically, he proved to be incorrect, or that proved to be outside of the possibility of the United States. But I think that idea was part of Johnson's thinking.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Thomas Allen Schwartz. He is Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt University. He's the author of the book, Lyndon Johnson and Europe, the subtitle In the Shadow of Vietnam, and it's published by the Harvard University Press. And it's an exploration of the kinds of moves and positions in the foreign policy arena that Lyndon Johnson made during his presidency toward Europe. Professor Schwartz, as he has here, makes the argument in the book that certainly Vietnam overshadows just about everything else, and that Lyndon Johnson's presidency should not overall be considered to be a failure in the foreign policy arena. That is, he made some very significant moves and toward Europe, and had a very strong commitment to the relationship between Europe and the United States. Again, questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL. At the moment, it seems that the relationship between the countries of Western Europe and the United States is on a little rocky ground. Certainly,
yes, yeah.
It seems that we've always had our ups and downs with the French, but that since the end of World War II, and have always had, generally speaking, a very solid relationship with the British. It seems that since the end of World War II and during the time of the Cold War, administration after administration recognized that Europe was important,
yes.
It was important this relationship be strong, and that now that since the end of the Cold War, that relationship has, at least in some people's minds, it has weakened to the point where they'd say it doesn't really matter anymore. At least some people in the current Bush administration have rather dismissed the countries of Europe, at least when they were. When they were speaking up and disagreeing with our policy as far as Iraq is concerned, and I wonder what you could say about the importance, whether this relationship continues to be important, and whether mm-hmm. you would say that it was perhaps wrong-headed to dismiss Europe and say that what they think doesn't matter to the United States.
Oh, I think, if anything, the last few months have demonstrated that for a variety of reasons, economics, politics, other issues, the United States has a tough time trying to go it alone, that it's worked most effectively when it can mobilize, in particular, some of the special resources of Europe and its role in the peacekeeping undertakings, economic development. That it can work best when it can work together with its allies. Now, that doesn't mean there's always going to be complete harmony, but I think the dismissal of the relationship is extraordinarily dangerous. The United States and Europe together were very, very effective in the long run in terms of the Cold War. If one really thinks about why the Cold War worked out the way it did, it's not a case of the United States having won it, in a sense, on its own. In many respects, the United States was able to mobilize an international alliance, maintain its cohesion, and in a sense wear down its rival and demonstrate that Western economic political system was better for people's lives in the long run, and created a sort of drawing power with Eastern Europe that influenced that region to be hostile to the Soviet Union. There was a domino theory in the Cold War. It's often been used in regard or dismissed in regard to the Vietnam War, but the dominoes did fall, and they fell in Eastern Europe when the Cold War came to an end in 1989. And that came to an end largely because of this ability of the United States and Europe to cooperate effectively together. So I think there's a tendency for some short-sighted policy analysts and others who don't think about long-term historical trends and in fact, some of these historical examples to dismiss the significance of the cooperative relationships of the alliance in producing the type of international world we want to see. And I think that has been dangerous. And I think, if anything, this administration has now been forced to recognize it by the sorts of challenges it's faced in the Middle East now and the need to get additional resources. American public opinion is notoriously short attention span on some of these issues in a way that I think can be detrimental to the type of long-term goals that we have in the Middle East.
We have another caller here, someone local in Champaign County. Let's talk with them. This will be line number one. Hello.
Hi. You've been talking a little bit about the, you said, I think, the nuclear proliferation, non-proliferation treaty was one of the biggest accomplishments. But, and then you, in the answer to the last question, you did talk about his attitude toward nuclear weapons as being unthinkable, unusable. Mm-hmm. It's not widely commented on that the nuclear NPT actually calls for eventually the major superpowers disavowing their use and getting rid of all of them. And there are people that are still talking about that in other parts of the world. I think there was some parliamentarian out of it that was just convened in Vienna just recently to still try and talk about that. I just wonder whether you think that Johnson was authentic in that he really saw that, or whether he was just being, you know, politically expedient, which is a likely scenario. I think the current crop, if you want to make an analogy to the current Texan, you know, that's absolutely beyond the pale. You don't think about giving up total spectrum dominance. They want more, actually. So what do you think of that?
I think Johnson, you know, it is hard to read Johnson. There's always a Johnson was a very political president, and he's calculating all the time. But I think my own reading, and this is from listening to tapes, reading documents, Johnson didn't put a lot down on paper. My own reading is that he was genuinely shocked about the potential destructiveness of nuclear weapons in a nuclear war. There was something, as Johnson used to put about mashing the button, and that wonderful expression that's, I guess, more native to the South than anywhere else, that the idea that he had that authority and what the potential harm would come, that I think lent a certain caution to him and to a sense of limits, and that I think his devotion or interest in trying to limit the dangers of the spread of nuclear weapons and here get beyond, even getting beyond I don't know about, obviously, I think in a perfect world he would have wanted them abolished, but I don't think Johnson was also a dyed-in-the-wool realist on all of these things. But certainly I think he did have a very, very strong conviction about the need to never come to the danger of a nuclear confrontation again. There was something very, very sobering about his reaction to his first briefing when he became president about the use of nuclear weapons that continues and shows up in a number of places in his presidency that I think was very genuine in him. And again, I recognize the difficulty of disentangling political expediency from genuineness in a politician like Johnson. But I think on nuclear weapons, it was a very genuine fear.
Well, the realist stance would have been, well, the Soviets are never going to make an authentic offer, so we don't have to worry about signing it. We'll never have to give them up. And it's basically an acceptance of MAD, mutual assured destruction. But now we're at a point where if there was popular pressure, there could be a complete, and we'd get out of this whole blackmail rogue state, this rogue state, the largest.
Well, I think
So, I mean, it's actually, the U.S. is the problem in that analysis, though.
The U.S. Yeah, I do think the situation is very different than it was during the Cold War, because the Cold War did put a limit. Johnson accepted the Cold War, and most leaders of that time accepted it as a fact of life, that, of course, both sides would always want to be nuclear-armed. Their feeling was trying to prevent proliferation with other smaller states that might, of course, bring a larger nuclear conflict. But, yes, I mean, the end of the Cold War does change that whole dynamic.
But it's the current people think that it's the competitive advantage, and that's what. Anyway, thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thanks for the call. When people think of Lyndon Johnson, often the assessment is quite harsh and quite negative. And in fact, you have a couple of quotes in your book from the man who I guess is considered to be the definitive biographer of LBJ, Robert Carroll, said that he was, quote, a man of utter ruthlessness and a seemingly bottomless capacity for deceit, deception, and betrayal. And then you go on to quote a former press secretary, George Reedy of Johnson, who published a memoir and described his former boss as, quote, a miserable person, a bully, a sadist, lout, and egotist. And, you know, probably some other things if you really would have been speaking in mind, stuff that we couldn't say on the radio. do you think that that is, and I'm sure that in some respects that all of that is completely true. And yet, do you think that that is, if that's the only impression that you have of Johnson, that's not doing justice to him?
Yeah, I think Johnson was a complicated character, and there's no question that I think it's interesting. One thing I don't go into a great deal of depth in the book on, but George Reedy, of course, Johnson's some of the most tense issues Johnson had to deal with dealing with the press. And George Reedy was the man in between Johnson and his problems with the press, and I think for that reason probably suffered more of Johnson's obnoxiousness than many others. But there were many sides to Lyndon Johnson, and his legacy is a complicated one. It's a legacy of enormous, in my view, enormous good domestically in civil rights and other areas, and as well in specific areas in international relations. But it's also a legacy of the Vietnam War. It's a legacy of failed initiatives in some of the programs of the War on Poverty and other areas, too. So I think he's a complicated figure, but I think distance and a certain even hesitate to say historical objectivity, we can move toward a more balanced view of Lyndon Johnson and a recognition of his achievements as well as his failures.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Schwartz, very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
And he's speaking with us from Vanderbilt, so we also want to say thanks to Anne-Marie Owens and all of the folks there at Vanderbilt for helping us with this high-quality communications link-up that we're able to do. Certainly much better than the telephone call that we do on so many shows. Thomas Schwartz is Associate Professor of History at Vanderbilt. If you would like to read the book that we have mentioned, it's titled Lyndon Johnson and Europe in the Shadow of Vietnam, and the publisher is the Harvard University Press.